This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
This evening we're going to try and understand something of the symbolism of the Mishkan, specifically, and in general the concept of symbolism altogether. Which seems to play quite an important part in the Torah. And on the surface, symbolism seems to be a concept that shouldn't have a place in the Torah. Because what is a symbol after all? It's not a real thing. And the Torah deals with reality. And a symbol is really a fake thing. It's not a real, it's not the genuine article. And yet we find symbolism in the Torah over and over again. There's some strange chazal on the Mishkan and its kelim. For example, in Parsha Lamed Gimel in the Medrash Rabbah on today's Sedra, V'yichuli Trumer Rabbi Brechia Pasach L'cho Hashem Agdulo V'agburo Kichol Bashamayim V'Oretz. For everything is both in heaven and on the earth. Ato Moitze Kol Ma Sheboro HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Malon Boro L'Mato. You find that whatever the Ribbono Shel Olam created up on the top, he created down here as well. Lemalan Zvul V'Arafel, and then he get the Chazal go through and list. You've got this up there, you've got this down here. Lemalan Srofim Oimdi Mimaloi, up in the heavens above, angels stand upright at Hashem's side. Lematon down here, Atzei Shittim Oimdim, you've got these wooden pillars of Shittim wood that stand upright in the Mishkan. Lamalan Kruvim, there are angels upstairs. Lamatan Viyua Kruvim, we've got angels formed on the out of gold on top of the Aruin down here. So the Medrash is saying that the parallels, there's a parallel for everything that is in God's world, there's a parallel down here. And the examples of two of the examples that the Medrash chooses to give are the Shittim wood pillars of the Mishkan represent the upright angels that stand in Hashem's world, and the formed golden angels that are molded on the top of the Aruin are the parallels of the angels of the Kruvim up in Shemayim. What's the connection? Are we pretending that this is some kind of reality? That these pillars have any kind of relationship to the Sofim that stand up in Hashem's world? That these golden objects of art have anything to do with the real angels that stand up in the Ribbono Shel Olam's world? What does it mean? With specific regards to the Shulchan, the Zohar says a fascinating thing, but equally difficult to understand. On Kuf Nun Gimel Amud Beis, Posach Rabbi Yosef Omer, V'yosiso Shulchon Atzei Shittim, and you shall make a Shulchon, a table of Shittim wood. Shulchon Do, Iu Kaima Legub Mishkin. This table is established and stands inside the Mishkan. Uvircheso Dile'elo Shario Ali. And the bracha, the blessings of the Ribbono Shel Olam rest upon this table, upon the shulchan. Uminei nofik mezoino lechol alma. And from the shulchan, from this table, there goes out food for the entire world. The entire world is fed from this table. The shulchan do leitzrich lemervi berikanya. And this table must never be left empty. Afilu rigo chado, even for one moment it mustn't be left empty. As they moved the old set of challah off, they replaced it immediately with a new set. There wasn't a moment that there wasn't bread on the table. And the Zohar says there wasn't allowed to be a moment without bread on the table. Elo lemevi alei mezoino, there always had to be food on that shulchan. Deho birchaso lo yishtakoch al oso rekanyo. For brocha, blessing cannot fall upon an empty place. Uveginkach itzrich lemevi aleinam otadir, and that's why there has to be bread on that table continuously at all times. The levi tadir birchaso ilo mishtachobe, so that there will always be brocha, blessing upon that table. Umigo hashulchan, and from that table, nafki birkon umezoine lechol sha'ar petori de alma. Blessing and food emanate from that table to every other table in the world. Every table is drawing from that table, from that shulchan. This barchoin begine, and those tables are blessed through this table. Amazing things the Zohar says. That this shulchan It's not just a symbol, but it plays a very important life, a very important part in the day-to-day lives, not only of the Jewish people, it would seem, but of all of humanity. That the tables, the bracha, the blessing, the nutrition, the food that exists on the tables in the entire world have as their source this table, this shulchan. That's what it appears to be. Also very difficult to understand. To explain this, I'm going to use the second medrash. I don't think tonight's going to be a long shiur, but it's a rather difficult shiur. And if it isn't going to be a long shiur, I might allow you to ask questions in the middle of it, because it's important that you understand the principles. Says the medrash at the end of the parsha, V'osiso es hakroshim l'mishka. Omer Rabbi Ovin said, Moshal l'melech shehoyo loy ikunin noeh. This can be compared to a king who had a very attractive appearance, very impressive face. That had responded. Omar Levin Beso, he said to one of the people of his household, Aseili kamoiso, duplicate my image. Omar Le, he said, Adoni Amelech Eich Yochol Ani Lasos kamoiso, how can I reproduce your appearance? How can I do such a thing? You with your paint and I with my glory. What the Medrash says. Kach Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu LeMoshe. So also Hashem said to Moshe, Re'ei ve'aseh, look and make. Omer Lefonav Ribbono Elom, Eloiko Ani Shani Yochel La'asos Keile. Do you think I'm God, says Moshe, that I can replicate your whole world? Because that's what we're saying, is that whatever is up there is being duplicated down, that this Mishkan represents God's world upstairs. And God says to Moshe, make a replica for me of my world. Says Moshe, what do you think? I'm a God? How can I make a replica? Omale ketavnisom bitcheles uvagaman v'tilas shoni. You don't have to use the same materials that I use. You use tcheles and argoman, you use the various dyes, and you use the thread, and you use whatever you can down there. And using your earthly materials, replicate what you see up in heaven. And if you will replicate what you see upstairs, you will replicate downstairs. I will leave my residence up there and I will place my Shechino, I will place my presence among you down there. That's what I'll do. A very difficult Medrash, and if we leave it at that, the Medrash is totally beyond comprehension. What is the Medrash saying? The Medrash brings the example of the painter and the king, and obviously in that example lies our understanding of the whole concept. What is a painting? What is any work of art? But let's start with a painting. What is a painting? Let us take two types of paintings. Let us take a painting of a landscape. It's a very beautiful painting where an artist is able to replicate a landscape. And when you look at that work of art, you go into an art gallery, you're going to buy a piece of art, and you look at this painting and it makes you feel good. And the more you look at it, the better you feel. And so you decide to buy it and you hang it up in your home. What happens when you see it? Why does it make you feel good? Let's assume that you're living in a miserable sort of a place where the weather's bad, it's always raining, it's always drizzling, always cloudy. You're living in Europe or one of these funny places. And this is a landscape of Africa, sunshine, wild animals, freedom, open spaces. Let's imagine that. And you originally come from Africa, let's say. You originally come from this part of the world. So it makes you feel nostalgic. You look at it and it reminds you of that life. You see the sunshine, you live the sunshine, you live the open veld, you live the bush veld. Imagine a picture of the Eastern Transvaal area out there, part of the game reserve, the little thorn bushes, the dry grass. Some elephants roaming in the background, strong sun, bright colors, and you're sitting in your little tiny apartment in Belgium or in Switzerland or wherever, London, rain pouring downstairs, the pipes are leaking, everything's cold, you've just come in from the outside, your raincoats are dripping, and you look at this magnificent painting on your wall and you're cheered up, you feel good. That's what a painting does. Or let's take a painting or a photograph of a beloved one. You have a photograph of a parent who's no longer alive, or in your office you have a photograph of your husband or of your wife or of your children. Makes you feel good. Why do these photographs and these paintings make you feel good? Because you confuse them with the real thing? Are you a meshuggah? That you look at a piece of paper, or that you look at a bit of canvas with some chemicals and paints on it, and it makes you think you're in Africa? Is that what it is? It's not that. That's not what it is at all. So what is it? What is an image in a piece of poetry that makes you feel, that makes you relate to an emotion, to a feeling, even when there's nothing else to cause that feeling to be felt other than the poetry itself? What is it that enables an image to create a feeling, to create an experience like the real thing? Before we analyze it, I'll give you a third example. A child plays with a doll, and the child pats the doll, and the child cuddles the doll, the child tucks the doll in, the child talks to the doll, and if you rough with the doll, the child gets angry, don't hurt the baby. And then the child decides to change her attention away from the doll and to get involved in some other game, and the doll's in the way on the table, and she pushes the doll off the table. And you say, don't just push the doll off the table, you'll hurt the poor dolly. And she says, don't be silly, it's only a doll. Now you're trying to figure out what goes through the child's mind. If it's only a doll, why do you cuddle it, and why do you dress it, and why do you talk to it, and why do you play with it? And if it's a real baby, how can you just throw it off the table? What is it? What does the baby think the doll is? The answer is, the baby thinks the doll is an image. The baby relates to the doll exactly the same way as you relate to the photograph or to the painting. So you might look at this photograph and it's very precious to you, and you put it in a very special place, and it arouses all sorts of feelings inside you, and you don't let anybody touch it, and you don't let anybody move it. But years later, maybe you've got a better photograph, a more accurate photograph. That's a photograph that was taken a long time ago. It's no longer current, it's no longer accurate. And you replace it with a new photograph. What do you do with the old photograph? You throw it away. And somebody looks at you and says, but I don't understand. When I once just touched that photograph, I moved it, you yelled at me. And now you've thrown it in the dustbin. Is it real for you? Does that represent the person or doesn't it? The answer is, it's an image. And as long as it's useful to me as an image, I relate to it as an image. When it's no longer useful to me as an image, it's nothing but a piece of paper. That's all it is. And so what is a work of art? Is it canvas and paint? Or is it an image? That depends on the individual. That depends on what you see in it. If you see in it an image, then that's what it is. When you cease to see an image in it, then it's nothing but canvas and paint. That's all it is. For an image to be effective, you need something physical. And that's where poetry is successful, although you can't touch poetry. Poetry uses words to paint a picture. But there has to be a real picture. And poetry fails when it doesn't paint a picture. There has to be a picture. So there has to be something material in order for an image to work. There has to be something you can see. There has to be something that you can visualize. And there has to be a feeling which it arouses in you, which is a real and true feeling that really does exist. It can't be something which is totally unreal. When those two merge together, you have a work of art. So what we're saying is something very far-reaching, and that is that something purely spiritual is very difficult to relate to. And when you do relate to it, it's only at that moment of relating. It's very difficult to preserve it. It's very difficult to keep it. You can have a moment of ecstasy, but when that experience is gone, the ecstasy goes with it. And we try and find ways to preserve that ecstasy. We try and find ways to hang on to it. We try and find ways to keep it, that we can relive it to some degree or other, that we can revise it, that we can go over it, that we can re-experience it. And one of the mechanisms we use is the mechanism of an image, to attach that experience to something physical. And that's why when people go traveling, they either take photographs or they buy souvenirs. What are the souvenirs for? People buy all these highly overpriced, useless little items and articles that they find all over. And they come back and they sometimes wonder why they bought them. The reason they bought them is to remind them of the feeling at the time that they bought them, the place where they bought them. It arouses that it ignites those memories. If one is able to relive it, every time he sees that little trinket, every time he sees that little object, he remembers the whole thing, how it went around and how he got in the little store where he bought it, and the people around and what the weather was like and what the scenery was like. It all comes to mind when he sees that physical thing. But if he doesn't have that physical thing, if he doesn't have that material object to which to attach these enormous experiences which are spiritual and untouchable, he hasn't got anything to relate to, he hasn't got anything to really handle. That's what he achieves with that physical memento or with a photograph. Not that the photograph is the real thing, but the photograph helps him relive it. That's why it's sometimes very, it's sometimes almost an unfair burden to impose on people to show them the photographs of your trips. Because you're very excited with it, and every photograph means a great deal to you. And every photograph is just the tip of an iceberg, and when you look at that photograph, you're not looking at the tip, you're looking at the whole iceberg. But when you show it to your friends, all they see is the piece of paper. They just see the photograph. They can't see anything more than that. And there's actually a gap of emotion when you're sharing your photographs with other people who weren't there. They can look and you can try and describe and so on, and if you're very good at descriptive abilities and they're very interested, you might succeed somehow in bridging that gap. But by merely showing the film to them or the picture to them, you're not really able to communicate what you're trying to communicate. You want to communicate what you felt like. And a photograph doesn't communicate what you felt like except to you. To you it will communicate what you felt like. And so we find that a spiritual experience with all its infinity and with all its eternity can be attached to something physical. And only when it is attached to something physical is it preserved. And we see that, for example, in the Mishkan. In the Mishkan we see that the experience of Har Sinai was preserved. At Har Sinai there was an unbelievable relationship between Klal Yisrael and the Ribbono Shel Olam. God talked directly to Klal Yisrael. They heard His voice. They heard Him talking. There was direct communication. There was intimate contact. And what about the Mishkan? Exactly the same. Hashem continued to talk to Moshe Rabbeinu in a way where he could hear every word from between the Kruvim. So he replicated Har Sinai, and there continued to be that communication that there was on Har Sinai continued to be in the Mishkan, because there was something physical to attach it to which enabled it to be preserved. It didn't have to be relegated to the past once it had something physical to be attached to. And so the king says to the member of his household, make a duplicate of me. And he says, I can't, how can I do that? He says, Ato b'simamanecho. Don't worry about giving my aura to the picture. You can't give my aura to the picture. All you can do is use paint. So you go ahead and use your paint. That's all I'm asking from you. The aura, I'll give it. The fact that I really exist will give it its aura. And so if you hang a picture up of the queen or of a powerful person, if that person didn't really exist, if he's just a figment of the artist's imagination, then it's a pretty picture. That's all it is, which might or might not arouse certain feelings in you. But if it's an accurate picture of a monarch, and particularly if it's a powerful monarch, then the power of that monarch attaches itself to that picture. And when you're looking at that picture, you're actually looking not just at the paper or the canvas and the paint. You're looking at the concept of that monarchy and all its glory, and it arouses in you that feeling of all that you have for the monarch. And you bring that right into your living room by hanging it over there. That's why some Hasidic sects like to hang pictures of their rabbeim in their houses. And sometimes not just in one room, but in every room, and in their motor cars and all over the place. Because it arouses in them a certain intimacy, a certain relationship. It's not that they're relating to the photograph, but without the photograph they feel they're not able to maintain and preserve that feeling of intimacy and that thrill they had during a time that they had some kind of contact with him. And the photograph reminds them of that feeling, not of the person, of that feeling that they had and of the aura that goes with it. And so just as you can take a photograph of a powerful or an important person and that photograph means something to you, it means something to you because it has behind it the aura of the true person. And so the king says to the member of his household, don't worry about replicating my aura. Just use your paints and you make the image. I'll give it the aura that it needs. The fact that I am the king, the fact that it replicates me, and I have the aura, that's all that is needed. The picture will have sufficient aura without that. So says the Ribbono Shel Olam to Moshe, don't try and replicate my world using my materials. You can't. My materials are spiritual and you're physical. You use physical material. Use what you've got down on your world. Use your wood and use your leather and use your cloth. Use whatever you've got there and your paints and dyes. Use normal things. And using those physical materials creates something physical, which is a replica of what you see in the spiritual world. And I will attach my spirituality to it, and the picture, the image will be complete. That's the image which is created. With that we understand also, to some degree, the very narrow line that exists between idolatry and worship. Very narrow line. It seems to us on the surface that idolatry is so far from anything we're accustomed to that we can't understand how it was ever attractive to anybody. We can't understand what ever got anybody to believe in an idol, to relate to an idol. All that has to happen is the separation of reality from the image. When the image is no longer attached to something real, but is something wondrous all on its own, unattached to something real, that the image ceases to be an image and the image becomes an idol. That's all. When you create an image of something that doesn't exist, when you create an image of something which doesn't rely on a real experience to give it its life, that's when you're dealing with an idol rather than with an object of worship. It's a completely different thing. Nobody served the Mishkan. Nobody served the Orin. Nobody looked at them as ends in themselves. They were looked upon as paintings, as works of art, designed to arouse in me the feeling of relating to the Ribbono Shel Olam's world. It was designed to be a replica of the Ribbono Shel Olam's world, and by seeing it and touching it and feeling it and smelling the korbonos, by using my senses and all my senses in my relationship with this object, an object designed to be a replica, I allow my senses to relive that intimacy that I felt with the Ribbono Shel Olam when I was at the foot of Har Sinai. That's what it enables me to do. So it's merely a conduit, it merely triggers in me feelings. But what are the feelings? The feelings are of a direct connectedness with the Ribbono Shel Olam, not a connectedness to the object. That's not what thrills me. When I look at that landscape of the African veld, when I'm sitting in my cold, miserable little apartment in Europe, I don't get excited because of the canvas. I don't get excited because of the paints. I don't even get excited because of the brilliance of the artist. What's exciting me is, it reconnects me with my memories of the veld. It brings me back to the veld. I feel myself there and I start smelling the smells and I start feeling the sunshine and I start hearing the sounds of the crickets and the sounds of the birds in the background. I hear it at that time. I smell it. I feel it. Not because I'm relating to the painting. I'm merely using the painting to transport me into another world. And not an imaginary world. A real world that I once experienced. And that I'm able to put myself back into, even though I'm thousands of miles away. And so it is with a memento or a photograph of a trip. It enables me to transport myself back into a real world that did exist, and that I did experience years and years ago. But I'm able to get back into it. And when I look at old photographs of my little children when they were small babies, and now they're married with children of their own, what does that do? I don't get excited because of the photograph. And tears don't run down my face because of the photograph. It's the memories, it's the feelings and the emotions that I feel when I look at the photograph. But what are those emotions? Not of connectedness with the photograph, but of connectedness with the children when they were little babies, and all the emotions and all the feelings that went on at that time in my life. That's what it enables me to do. If my feelings stop at the photograph, if they stop at the souvenir or they stop at the canvas on the wall, and that's what I get excited about as an end in itself, then it becomes idolatry. It's no longer art. It's no longer imagery. Then it becomes idolatry. When I'm willing to pay $3 million for a canvas just because that's what they say it's worth, it doesn't do anything for me, it doesn't make me feel anything, that's what they say it's worth, so okay, that's what I'll pay for it. That's idolatry. Then I'm relating to it as an object, and I'm placing value in it as an object, not what I can do with it. If I do it as an investment, fine, then it's a piece of business. It's like buying a property or shares in the stock market. It has nothing to do with art. But if you have a person who feels nothing, he's buying it because he wants a work of art. He holds himself up as somebody who appreciates the arts, wants a work of art, and he goes and he sees all sorts of paintings. Some of them really get him excited. But the art gallery owner says to him, no, that one's an unknown artist. And that one you're getting excited about, it's not a very good painting. Yeah, I'll show you something that's really good. He says, but it doesn't make me feel anything. He says, it doesn't matter. But this one costs $3 million. It's really good. What does that mean? That means it is relating to the object and not to what the object does to him. Not to what lies behind the object. The object is not something to be used to elevate the human being, but the object becomes an end in itself. That's idolatry of one form or another. And if Bnei Israel Chas V'Sholem would have related to the Oron and to the Mishkan as an end in itself, that's the object and that's the object of value, that would have been idolatry. And we saw that happen in fact with the golden calf. And we can now understand what happened with the golden calf. They too thought that through the golden calf it would arouse in them certain memories and certain feelings and certain emotions, and they would use the golden calf as a work of art, not as an object of devotion, not as an idol. But it didn't do that. That's not how it functions, and that functioned, and that's not how it worked. It became an object of devotion and dedication. It didn't become an object of art designed to arouse within them feelings of higher spirituality. Let us now look at a Ramban that is based on this Zohar that we did this evening. Those of you who would like to see the Ramban inside, we have photostats from last night still, so we can have a look at them inside. Down at the bottom of the page you'll find the Ramban on Pasuk Chof Dalet. The Ramban comments on the Rashi that says that the golden surround on the table was an image of a crown. Here again we have the image. It says Rashi, the Ramban quoting him, Simon Lecheser Malchus. This is an image for a crown of royalty. Shal Shulchon Shem Usher Ugdulohu. For the table represents wealth and greatness. Kamo Sheimrim Shulchan Malochim. As we talk about the tables of kings. Loshon Rashi, that's what Rashi says. Vechein Hadover, says the Ramban. And that is so. Shezeh Soid HaShulchon. That is the Kabbalistic, deeper inner meaning of what the Shulchan is. Ki birkas Hashem me'ez ha'yoyis ha'olam lo'nivro yesh me'ayin aval olam kimin hogoy noyheg. That since the time of the creation of the world, creation ab nihilo ceased to exist. Up until the end of the creation, the Rabbeinu Shlom created out of nothing. Thereafter the Ribbono Shloim ceased to create out of nothing, but he programmed nature to be able to recreate itself. Dichtiv, as it says, Vayare Elokim es kol asher oso v'hinei tov moed. Hashem saw everything that he did, and it was very good. And in the notes, Rabbi Shavel brings the Zohar from Bereishis, where at the end of the piece the Zohar comments, Da kol uvdin de Bereishis. That's all that was created in Bereishis. The toman ispri yesoido veikra lechol ma de yesi veyischadish ba'alma levosokein. For during those 6 days there was created the foundation and the roots of anything that would be created for the rest of eternity, for the rest of time. So in the 6 days of creation, Hashem created the source of everything. And that's what the Ramban says here, that after the creation there was no new creation. Aval, however, kasher yiye shom shorish dovo, provided there is the root of something left, tochul olov abrocha, blessing can fall upon that root. Vatosif boy, and it can cause that root to grow. So after the 6 days of creation, we no longer have creation, we have growth in its place. And there's no limit to the growth. But there can't be, but there's nothing created out of nothing. Something has to be there to start with, otherwise there's no bracha. And the Ramban gives a few examples. Kasher Omar Elisha, Agidili Mayeshlach Babayis, as Elisha said to the Shunamis, when she was so desperately poor and didn't have another thing to eat. And Elisha comes and he says, what do you have? You must have something. If you have nothing, there's nothing I can do for you. If you have something in the house, no matter how small and insignificant, I can do something for you, but you need to have something. And the brocha was applied to that little container of oil, and it filled all the other kelim. Everything else got filled up as a result of it. As we have on Chanukah itself. Had there not been that one little container of oil, we couldn't have had the miracle of Chanukah. The miracle of Chanukah was that the one little cruse of oil could go for 8 days. That was the miracle. And with Eliyahu also, the little container of flour and of oil didn't ever run out. And likewise, the table, the shulchan and the mishkan with the bread on top of it, on that bread, brocha was placed. Brocha was able to apply itself. And now the Ramban says, based on the Zohar that we learned, umimenu yovoy hasova lechol Yisrael. And from that there will come satisfaction to all of Israel. We now see that a symbol, let's understand the symbol, symbolism and imagery, and move from an artistic appreciation of a symbol and imagery to a Kabbalistic appreciation of a symbol and imagery. And what we're saying is that the infinite, that is, for example, the emotions you feel as a result of looking at the image, that's infinite, that's eternal, that's spiritual, that's not physical, can be attached to a physical object, no matter how small and insignificant that physical object is. So you might go to the Kotel in Yerushalayim for the first time, and you might have the most unbelievable spiritual encounter at the Kotel, where you find yourself for a few brief moments on the highest of spiritual planes that you could ever imagine yourself reaching. And then it's a question of how do you try and recapture that? What are you going to do when you come home? And you take a photograph, or perhaps not even that, perhaps on your way into the Kotel, you were wearing maybe a sort of a touristy cap, so a man standing there didn't know whether you were frum or you weren't, and he gave you one of these paper yarmulkes, you know, these crinkled paper yarmulkes. And you smiled and you took it from him and you put it in your pocket and you decide to keep it. And you come home one evening late at night, you're thousands of miles away from the Kotel, many months away from that experience, you've never had it before or since, and you're sitting in the late hours of the night in your study, preparing some Gemara for the next day, and you feel in your pocket, and that same paper yarmulke is there. And you take it out, and as you touch it and as you see it, that whole experience in a flash comes back to you. What's happened? A little piece of crinkle paper was able to do that? Yes. There is no limit to how much in feeling, in spirituality, can be attached to something even very, very tiny and insignificant and cheap. It doesn't matter. And we see that the fact that an artist can take a canvas and some paint that costs in total a few rand, 10 rand, 25 rand maybe, if it's a really good canvas with really good paints, and from that he can create something that people will pay millions of dollars for. Why? Not just because it's clever and it's been created, you can take a photograph of it and you'll still have it. Why the original? Because it makes them feel something, it arouses something in them. That's why. There is no limit to the growth. You can take a piece of canvas that's worth 25 rand, and by using it correctly you can make it worth millions of rand, millions of dollars in a few minutes. You can do that. That's what brocha can do. That's what brocha means. Brocha is the taking of something physical and the attaching to it infinite spiritual meaning. Or not necessarily spiritual. It's sometimes physical. It's sometimes material. But it's the infinite. It's the attaching of the infinite to that which is finite. The attaching of the spiritual to that which is material. The attaching of the eternal to that which is temporal. That's what brocha is. There's no more creation of nothing, of something from nothing. But the extension of something into everything, that continues. That you can take one or two little cells, reproductive cells, and from that they can be developed a genius of a human being who can change the entire world. That's growth, that's brocha, that's natural and that's miraculous. Whatever word you want to use, it makes no difference. Growth is part of nature and growth is miraculous. That you can take a little tiny seedling and you can create out of that a tree that is hundreds of meters high and very strong and powerful, that can withstand all the winds that affect it. That's nature and that's miraculous. That's growth. That you can invest a small amount of money into a business and you can apply your mind to the business and 20 years later the business can be worth millions and millions of rands. That's natural, that's miraculous, whatever word you want to use. That's growth, that's brocha. All these are signs, are expressions of brocha. That's what brocha means. Taking something small and insignificant and allowing it to grow and to develop into something big and mighty, into something that might be infinite in fact. That's the power of brocha. And that's what symbolism is. Symbolism is that little shoresh, that little root of something material on which you can work in order to create something much bigger out of it. On which you can work to make something spiritual, to make something infinite, to make something emotional out of it. One little thing that starts, that's the semen, that's all you need, is the image. And therefore what you begin to see is that our whole life is just images. Because we work with growth. Growth is an absolute requirement. And we work with small things to start with and we develop them into big things. That's what life is. We work with a symbol and we develop them into something much bigger. We develop them into something much more powerful. If that is so, why is it that oil doesn't just grow and multiply as it did in Elisha's and Eliyahu's case? Why is it that whatever we have doesn't just That explains Rabbi Yeruchim is what happened with the sin of Adam HaRishon. That's what the curse of the land was. When Hashem said you'll have to now earn your living by the sweat of your brow, that means that brocha will no longer always be natural. That things will have to be on a certain level in order for them to be natural. And the lower their level, the more input you'll have to put into them to make them grow. If it weren't for the sin of Adam HaRishon, you wouldn't have to put any energy into the world that would grow automatically. You wouldn't have to till the world. You wouldn't have to water it. You wouldn't have to nurture it. You wouldn't have to fertilize it. You could leave it alone and everything would grow. But after the chait of Adam HaRishon, it became necessary to apply man's energy and his creative genius into the world in order to make the world grow. And the lower the level of the world, the more creative genius has to be applied to it in order to make it grow. And therefore, if we could find ways of elevating growth, imagine when you're sitting in your little miserable flat in Europe, if you could have recordings of the thunderstorms in Johannesburg, how happy it would make you. You should send that away to friends and relations who've emigrated. It's surprising what makes them excited. You know, people often talk, a Kit Kat chocolate gets them all excited, a bottle of fish paste or Marmite gets them all excited, all sorts of things they never really used to eat here. Why does it get them so excited? And they pay fortunes for it. This makes them feel good, makes them remember home. You send them recordings of thunderstorms, tears will come down their eyes. If we could find ways of elevating the material world back to its position that it was before the chait, then automatically it would multiply. It wouldn't need any effort. And here we have the Ramban telling us, giving away Elisha's secret. How did Elisha do the miracle? What did he do? He simply took that little bit of oil and restored its spiritual status to what it was before the sin. Once he did that, the oil just flowed, there was no end to it. That's how the world was created, that's how it was meant to be. And so in our lives too, if we are able to relate, as in the case of the Mishkan, what is the Mishkan? The Mishkan too was creating a little environment, a little controlled environment that was absolutely 100% in accordance with the Torah. That every little screw, that every little hook, that every little detail was made and maintained 100% according to halacha. So what is the result of such a place? Bracha, natural growth. And who owns the Mishkan? Who built the Mishkan? The whole of Klal Yisrael. Everybody had a share in it. Everybody brought their trumas. Everybody brought their donations. Everybody had a share in that Mishkan. And everybody had a share in that shulchan, that table that had this bracha. So this bread which sits on the table can multiply and multiply and multiply. It doesn't have to multiply on that table. It can multiply on the table of any of its owners. And who owns it? The whole of Klal Yisrael owns it. And if Klal Yisrael is being supported by the rest of the world, they have shares in Klal Yisrael. So if they have shares in Klal Yisrael, and Klal Yisrael have shares in the Mishkan, and the Mishkan owns the Shulchan with the bread on it, then the bracha of the bread emanates to every table of every shareholder of the Mishkan, which can be ultimately, and it's meant to be, every citizen of this world is meant to be a shareholder of the Mishkan. The other nations, by their contribution to Klal Yisrael, and Klal Yisrael through its contribution to the Mishkan, every human being becomes a shareholder in the Mishkan. And the dividends from that Mishkan, which is constant bracha that comes from that Shulchan, get constantly fed out to every shareholder all the time, right onto their tables. And that's why the Ramban finally says on the Kach Omru, Kol Kohen Shemagia Kepul, every Kohen who even was able to get only a crumb of the Lechem upon him, Oichel V'Soveah, he became satisfied from that crumb. That's what Bracha is. Bracha doesn't necessarily mean physical multiplication. It sometimes means giving the effect of physical multiplication. There again, you can have a little memento which can bring back big feelings of big experiences, of big expanses of space. Little memento. And it can make you feel satisfied. And that's strange, you might ask yourself. To feel satisfied, I had to undertake this trip and it cost me 10,000 rand and I had to be away for 3 weeks from my business in order to get that feeling. And now I come home and I look at a little photograph that costs 50 cents and I have the same feeling. How come? That's how it is. Bracha doesn't necessarily mean that you have an increased quantity. Sometimes bracha is that you need a decreased quantity, that you are satisfied more easily, that you're able to feel the effects of satisfaction with less quantity. And in fact, our pursuit of quantity in modern life is a result of the absence of bracha, not the existence of bracha. We need quantity to substitute for our inability to be satiated, to be satisfied. And so we want more and more, and we need more and more constantly. The Zohar asks an interesting question. A few paragraphs earlier from the one that I just read to you. It says, V'ochalto V'sovato uverachto es Hashem Elokech. This is where we learn the obligation to bench from. You shall eat and you shall be satisfied and you shall bless the Ribbono Shel Olam. Ask the Zohar, V'chi ad lo yochil ba'anash v'savo v'yismale kreisei lo yavarech lo yelokech shabrichu? Does that mean I'm not allowed to bless the Ribbono Shel Olam until my tummy's full? That sounds a bit odd, it sounds a bit coarse. You've got to eat and fill yourself and satisfy yourself. When you're about popping, then thank the Ribbono Shel Olam. And if you want to thank him before that, you can't. How do we understand this? That Hashem says, first eat and then be satisfied and then you can bless me. However, even if a man only eats a kezayis, the quantity of an olive, but his intention is on that olive. He eats it with kavona. He eats it with understanding. He eats it with his mind on it. He eats it with his senses focused on it. He eats that one olive as if that's his entire world. That's his food. That's his meal. He puts everything he's got into the full appreciation of this one kazayis of bread. And he makes that one little kazayis his main food, the main part of his meal. Seveo ikri, he's called satisfied. That's, he's had seveo, that will satisfy him. Even one kazayis will do. Now that sounds odd, but it really is so. Because I've seen Americans who go to Europe or to Japan to a fancy restaurant, and they serve the meal that cost them about 4 or 5 times what it cost them in America, and they come out very hungry, and they can't understand what they paid all that money for. And when you see what they're dished up to eat, it's very small, tiny little portions. And yet you see people who trained in that culture who are very, very satisfied with that. Makes them feel very satisfied indeed. It's not just the quantity that makes one satisfied. If one's trained in a culture that learns how to appreciate quality instead of quantity, that learns how to find all the different tastes, that learns how to cook food properly, that's number one. The Europeans and the Japanese and others know how to prepare food. The Americans haven't learned that yet. So since they haven't learned how to prepare food, they just fill it up with bulk. But if one knows how to prepare food in such a way that a small quantity of food contains both nutritionally and from a taste point of view an enormous richness, and the person eating knows how to appreciate that richness, you don't have to eat that much. That's why people get obese. They eat too much. Why do they eat too much? Because they need much more. They're hungry. Why are they hungry? Because they don't know how to find pleasure in little things. And if people would be able to find pleasure in little things, whether it's in food, in people, in life, in aesthetics, they would find themselves being satisfied and enriched so much more easily, with so much less. That's what it means. Ezehu oshir asameach b'chelcho. A rich person is one who finds simcha in what he's got. It's not one who's satisfied in what he's got. That means really he's hungry and he doesn't enjoy it at all. But what can he do? You say to him, how things are you? Everything okay? He says, what can you do? Sameach b'chelcho, I'm satisfied with what I've got. That's not what it means. What it means is the person is sameach b'chelcho. He's happy, he's full, he's rich with what he's got. He doesn't need any more. Whatever richness in life he needs, he's able to get from what he's got. That's an oshi. That's somebody who has seveo. So the Zohar says satisfaction is not a function of quantity. Satisfaction is a function of the way you eat. And you could be satisfied even if you've had nothing to eat for many hours. One kazayis can satisfy a human being if he knows how to eat. If he has the skills and the artistry of being able to eat properly. And that's what it means in Ashrei when we say, and I've never understood this pasuk before. Poseach es yodechu masbia lecho chai rotzoin. We say every day, 3 times a day. Hashem opens, you open your hands, and you satisfy every living being. And every time I say that pasuk, something jars inside me. But it's not true. How can I say it? There's so many human beings who are not satisfied. There's so many human beings who are dying of starvation. There's so many people who feel unsatisfied. How can we say, Poseach es yodechu masbia lechol chai rotzoin? Says the Zohar, lechol chai achila lo kesiv. It doesn't say, Hashem, you open your hand and satisfy every living being with food. It doesn't say that. Ela rotzoin. You satisfy every human being with the ability to find satisfaction in small quantities of food. That's what you've given human beings. Whether they choose to use it or not is their own business. But every human being can find severe or can find satisfaction with a very small amount. How reuso the shavi al how michlo. That rotso in that satisfaction, that thought process, that emotion that a person puts on his food, severe ikri, that's called satisfaction. And if a human being has nothing but that one little kazayis, below yosu, nothing more, he is able to find satisfaction in that one kazayis. And that's why it says Hashem satisfies every living being with rotzoin, with the ability to find satisfaction in that food. שעדו ובערכתו ועדו וישחי ובנה שלוולכו ללכות שבריחו וגילמה וחד ולאילו. And that's why it says, ואוכלתו וסבתו ובערכתו, you shall eat. It's not saying you shall eat until you're satisfied and then you shall bless Hashem. You shall eat even a little bit vesavato and you can find that satisfying. Uveirachto, and then you can bench immediately. That's all you have to do. It's not saying vochalta, start eating and eat some more and eat some more and have your first course and your second course and your third course, your main course, and it should be piled up with a lot of meat and a lot of vegetables and a lot of salad and have it with a lot of bread, and if that still doesn't satisfy you, have it a second time and have it a third helping, and then have your sweets and your desserts, and then have coffee and cake, and if you're still not satisfied, you better have some more cake, because you're not allowed to bench unless you're satisfied, so you better be satisfied. That's not what it means. That's what the Zohar starts asking. Is that what it means? No. What it means is the ochalto, learn how to eat. And then you will find that visavata, as you eat your first mouthful visavata, you will have had enough already. Uberachto, and then you can bless the Ribbono Shel Olam. And what are you thanking him for? Not just for the food, but for the ability of finding satisfaction in small things. That's what we're really blessing the Ribbono Shel Olam for. And that ties back to the Ramban's last phrase. That if there is brocha, a Kohen could get a crumb of the Lechem Aponim and be satisfied because it has brocha. But the Lechem Aponim belongs to all of Klal Yisrael, not just to the Kohanim. And therefore that brocha finds its way onto every table of Klal Yisrael, into every family, into every household. We begin to see what the Mishkan is, what the Beis HaMikdash was, what symbolism is. We begin to see that we're working with symbols all the time. If a person has a kezayis of food and he eats it and that satisfies him, why does it satisfy him? Because the kezayis is only a symbol of food, not real food. It's a symbol, but that's sufficient, because the symbol is that shoresh, is that little root to which infinity can be attached. As long as the little root is there, there is no limit to how much can be attached to it. If the little root isn't there, you'll die of starvation. If you don't have the kezayis, you'll die. You have to have that. But once you've got that, there is no limit to how satisfying that can be. You need two conditions. The one is there has to be brocha in the object. There has to be a certain purity in the object. That will depend on how the bread was baked, how the wheat was grown and harvested and milled, what kind of people, with what kind of intentions. But if it were all done with Kedusha, there would be brocha in it, and it would be able to satisfy so much. And it depends also on the ability of the subject, of the human being who's eating it, to know how to eat, to know how to identify brocha, to know how to find all that infinity in these little things, in these little objects. So when you read this and you understand this, we realize how far off the track the world is. We're worried about nutrition. We're worried about malnutrition. We're worried about people dying of starvation. So what are we doing? It's as cockeyed as what we're doing about AIDS. We're worried about AIDS. So what are we doing? Not banning homosexuality. That we're not doing. We're trying to find cures for AIDS. That's what we're doing. All the money and all the effort that is being taken away from other diseases, that is being taken away from other research, and being put into this area which could be stopped so easily. No, we're going the crazy way, the long way around. And we wonder why there's poverty in the world. And we're worried about malnutrition, so what do? Here we see that if there would be more Kedusha in the way we live, in the way we made our food, in the way we prepared our food and ate our food, we would need a fraction of what we're using. That's the answer to malnutrition. Not to cut down populations and to do all sorts of other things. That's not the answer to malnutrition. Yeah, and obesity, the same problem. Malnutrition and obesity is exactly the same. An inability to understand how to use food and how to make food and how to prepare it. But if there's Kedusha in the preparation of our food, if there's Kedusha in our kitchens, if there's Kedusha at our tables, and within ourselves we know how to relate to food, and it's not only food, it applies to every other area, the same with our businesses. If we could raise the spiritual levels of our businesses and see that there's Kedusha there too, and our professions, then there would be brocha there, then there would be blessing. And we would find that with diminished input we could get exaggerated output. Less input and more output. That's brocha. Brocha is not more output. Work harder and destroy yourself more and kill yourself more, and eventually it grows bigger so that your heirs will be able to have the benefits of your hard work. That's not brocha. Brocha is less input needed for greater output. And the economists will tell you that's not possible, and we'll say it is possible. Because in every little speck of material matter, there is an infinite amount of spiritual energy that can be released, just waiting to be released, if we'll only know how. And just as Einstein found out how to release material energy, infinite material energy from every little speck of matter, so we need to know that there's an enormous amount of spiritual energy that can be released from every speck of matter. And if we'll learn how to raise our material environments onto a higher level of Kedusha, and how to develop within ourselves the sophistication of being able to identify, enjoy and relate to these small things and find great output in small objects, then we will find ourselves having solved the problems of malnutrition and obesity all in one go. Because we'll need to eat less, we'll need less, and we'll have more. And when a person needs less and have more, that is brocha. There is no greater brocha than that. And partially on the subject I did mention last week in the question of business ethics, that Dr. Meir Tamari will be coming out to this country. He'll be arriving next Friday, so he'll be a guest in the Beis HaMedrash next Shabbos and the Shabbos afterwards, and he'll be speaking after the Kiddush in the morning. Dr. Tamari, as I mentioned last week, was the chief economist of the Israeli Reserve Bank and has done a lot of work in business ethics, trying to raise the level of Kedusha in the material world in which we're operating every day. And in that one we'll find the brocha, and that's part of his theme, that's part of his thesis. In addition to that, he'll be speaking, there'll be various lectures and shiurim which will be advertised, some of them in the Beis HaMedrash, some of them in various other centers of the town. If you can watch the press and for posters, we'll give you details of those opportunities. I might add that it's costing us a little bit of money to bring or to arrange this visit for Dr. Tamari. So if among you there's anybody who's able to assist in the sponsorship of that visit, that would be very helpful. Even small amounts would be helpful. It would take the burden off the organizers from all the various arrangements that have to be made. Thank you and good luck.